And now, the Big D and Bubba Weekly Podcast.
Big D and Bubba, they have a show 5 days a week, but they don't get to say everything that's on their mind, so they have an extra one, and that's how we get the podcast.
The podcast, podcast, the podcast, the podcast.
Big D and Bubba's podcast, the podcast, the podcast.
Yeah.
Big D and Bubba's podcast.
Oh, yeah. That's like such that? A hot little song there, man.
Little ditty.
Little ditty by Big D and Bubba.
Who is that?
That is the lovely and talented Patrick, who is sitting right there to your side, who's saying our
podcast. Yeah, you loved it, didn't
our
you?
Yeah,
theme.
I did love it.
That's actually good.
It's actually good. Like, he's surprised. Like, it's actually good. Yeah, it is. You know what's going to happen? It's like 2 or 3 hours from now, you're going to be driving around and just going to be
that's
going to
be in
gonna
my
go,
head.
The podcast.
Absolutely.
Our bud Jimmy Wayne stopped by. Woo! Okay, you
sure.
Guys do that. You switch over there because you took Patrick's headphones.
That's right.
Real quick, this summer at Subway, explore flavors from around the globe. Now, this is where I have a hard time because all these around the globe words really mess with me.
Oh, boy.
You got the Lay's passport to flavor chips, the creamy zip of Greek tzatziki. Mm-hmm. Did I say
good
that
job.
Right?
Yeah.
It is right?
Yeah.
The spicy heat of Chinese
Szechuan.
Yeah. I'm just going to say Szechuan. And then the exotic tikka masala.
That's right. That's really good. Yeah.
Wow. Look at me.
I didn't know they had tikka masala.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Good.
Even the bold steakhouse flavor of
tikka
Brazilian pecan. Oh, here's one. How do you pronounce P-I-C-A-N-H-A? Picanha?
Yeah,
picanha. Brazilian meat. It's good. And then you pair it with all your favorite sandwiches for the full jet set experience. So, you know, it's like all around the world with the passport to flavor. And you can also try the Subway Chicken Caesar Melt, which is mega popular. Perfect with the cool crispness of Lay's wavy Greek tzatziki chips. That's right. I said it right. Hurry to Subway now to experience a whole new world of flavor with Lay's passport to flavor chips before they are gone.
Let me do the official introduction and welcome. Jimmy Wayne is with us.
Jimmy
is a friend, and he is also a he's an artist, of course. He's a social changer. He is a
social changer.
Yeah, he tries to change things,
change the world
for the better. But he said he's going to walk across America and was going to do it for. To raise awareness for those who are aging out of the foster care system. Basically, here's what happens. You're up for adoption. Okay, a kid is up for adoption. If you get adopted, great. But if you don't, you then are in a foster home.
Or aging out.
Or you stay with a family.
Well, some of these kids are in a receiving home, a group home. Some of them are living with you know, complete strangers, if you will. They're moving around, couch surfing. They're in and out of foster care, but they're in the system.
My cousin, actually, they probably throughout the years have had 15, maybe 20 kids, different kids stay with them for a while. Yeah. They had two twins that they kept together. It was a brother and a sister, and they tried to adopt them.
That's good.
But the family didn't want to let the child go.
Yeah.
They're like, no, or the children go. They're like, no, we're good. We're going to keep the babies.
That's a problem. That's a problem right there because the reason they're in the home, the foster care system, there's a reason why they're in there. And it's not because the family was a good family.
Right.
So to give them back to a family, that's the reason they were in the home to begin with or the system. To me, personally, unless that
defeats
family—
defeats the purpose?
Yeah, well, unless that family has completely rehabilitated. But what is rehabilitation? It's going back to square one. It's what you know. So if your square one is, you know, dealing drugs is normal or, you know, that's your rehabilitation. That's square one. So it's not, it doesn't work. These kids end up back in the system. That's what happened to my sister now. Let's
start from the beginning because your story is amazing from the beginning. And I'm not even talking about from whenever you met the elderly couple that took you in. Mm-hmm. I'm talking the beginning. Are you comfortable telling?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I wrote about it in my book, Walk the Beautiful. I mean, I wrote every memory I had, I could think of. I mean, everything that, I mean, taste, sound, touch, everything I could remember. And life was wonderful in the very beginning. I remember living in Johnsonville, South Carolina, literally in the middle of a cornfield. We were surrounded by cornfields, and behind the house behind the cornfield was pine trees. That's all I remember. And I remember peanuts and watermelon in the garden. So it was just an all-American lifestyle. I mean, it was just church on Sunday and Wednesday. And there was no cursing, no alcohol.
Typical nuclear family.
Absolutely. Very
perfect.
Sterile.
Everybody's doing what they're supposed to be
very
doing.
Very sterile. We went, and we had Christmas presents every Christmas. I mean, it's just normal. And then all of a sudden, my mom tells my sister to wake me up. She wakes me up. We load up the car while my stepdad is in bed asleep. And she drives away and never goes back. She never goes back to him. It was unbelievable. And then we drove all the way to North Carolina to my granddad's house that was a bootlegger. His house smelled like cigarettes, you know, rolled up cigarettes. He hand rolled.
Right.
And it smelled like an old musky basement. And it smelled like urine. Because he was just a lazy old guy. He would, you know, pee in
the corner like
pee in what those things that they had back in the old days.
Yeah,
like a bedpan?
Yeah, a pot.
Yeah.
And it would just, the house stunk. And it was just old. It was a very old, old, old house. And cold, and had antique furniture that was not good antique furniture, but really old, beat up antique furniture. And my granddad kept a gun in his pocket, and he sold liquor. And we went from that lifestyle to that lifestyle and overnight. I mean, we went to bed in Johnsonville, woke up, and was the next morning was in North Carolina in this house. So we just, life was like that all the time. And by the time I was 8 years old, we ended up living in Gastonia, North Carolina, on a street called Vance Street. We didn't know it, but it was a very... It was the roughest area of that city, and the housing was very cheap. My mom, being a single parent, didn't have enough money to afford something nicer. So we moved into this house, and that house just immediately became like a refugee camp for drug addicts, prostitutes, I mean, anything.
She wasn't doing that to help them out. She was taking them in for personal reasons?
No, actually, my mom, she just has a wonderful heart. But then she has.
Oh, so
this,
it really was like a refugee camp. It
was. Well, no. It was like a refugee camp. It was like my mom, when we moved into this house, she saw someone that needed help, and she said, "Well, just you can sleep in our couch for the night." Well, they wouldn't leave, so they just one by one just started coming in, and they just took over the house. It was like cockroaches. I mean, they would not go away.
And she wouldn't tell them to leave because
didn't matter. She could tell them to leave, and then my mom, being around this, she just fell deeper into it, and the alcohol, and she never was on drugs. She just drank a lot. And so these people befriended her, you know, and she felt sorry for them. And next thing you know, there was fights breaking out, and there was cocaine, and there was prostitution. There was all this stuff that would just happen right in the middle. I remember being 7 years old, 8 years old, and that we had a gunfight in the middle of the day, just right shooting the people across the street. They were shooting our house. And we were shooting their house.
Like pirate ships on
just
the water.
It was just like it. In the middle of the broad
That's
daylight.
It's like crazy, man.
It was crazy. So experienced like three murders before I was 9 years old. And that was rough, man. Seeing that kind of stuff was just crazy. So coming from that lifestyle to that lifestyle, and inevitably ended up in foster care when I was 8 years old. 9 years old, in and out when I was 10 and 11 and 12. And, you know, by the time I was 13, my mom had been in prison and had just gotten out of prison and married a guy who I thought was going to be a wonderful stepdad, but he ended up committing a crime. He shot somebody, and read about it in my book. But he took us on this long run from the law, and we left North Carolina, headed to Oklahoma City, down to Texas, back to Pensacola, Florida, and I'm in the backseat of this car. We'd been living in this car.
Now, did you know that you guys were running from the law at the time?
Oh, yeah, totally. I watched him shoot him. I watched him shoot this individual. Very sad situation. But he told my mom and I to get in a car. We loaded up everything, and we just fled to North Carolina. So we're sleeping in this car at rest areas, and mom's putting shirts under her shirt, pretending she's pregnant, collecting money. He was pulling in the gas stations and filling up the gas tank and driving off, you know, not paying And we did this all the way to Oklahoma and, like I said, to Texas and back to Pensacola. And I'd never been out of my little town in North Carolina, much less being in another city. It was like a foreign country to me. And I was in a back seat of the car, and they he made me get out. It was the middle of the night. He made me get out of the car, and I got out.
You just
out.
Pulled over and said, get out?
Yes. Pulled into a parking lot and said, get out.
And how old?
I was 13. And so I woke up to him telling me this, and I was looking around for my mom. And she was in the at the back of the car, leaning against the trunk of the car. And
she knew what was going on.
Yeah, it was pitiful, man. She was very abused by him, and she kissed me on the face, and I'm standing there holding my bags, and she kissed me on the face, and got back in the car.
What about your sister?
She was already married. She's 14 years old and got married.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the lifestyle that these kids go through.
Wow.
Yeah, our story's normal to them.
So okay. So they drop you off. Now you're sitting there, and you're on the side of the road. You watch the car go off. Taillights. That's all you see. Mm-hmm. Just nothing but taillights. And then, then what happens?
Well, I saw a light on inside of a bus station. It was a Trailways bus station, and I went in and just said, "I need help getting home to North Carolina." And this gentleman behind the counter, you know, asked me how much money I had, and I had $79 because I was always a worker. And I'd been cutting grass and saving up my money for the past 2 years. And just so happened, that ticket happened to be $79.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, do you think it really was $79? Or do you think he said, that's $79.
That's perfect. $79. That's perfect.
Wow.
Yep. I don't know.
I want to hope in my heart that he covered the rest of whatever it was, you know, whatever the difference was.
I hope so.
It would have sucked if it was like a $40 ticket and he took.
It was, as an adult, you look back and think, man, that ticket was $79.
Exactly.
And that's exactly, man.
That doesn't happen.
That didn't happen. That was pure. Anyway, I got on the bus, and I was 13. I was this dirty kid that had been living in this car and obviously hadn't taken a bath in a while. And just people treat you different when you're poor. You know, I know the difference now. You know, like when you're out there on stage and people are taking pictures of you and wanting your autograph. I remember what it was like being extremely poor and different.
And no one wanting to even look at you.
And no one wanting to look at me. And so I got both experiences, if you will. And being a kid and being hungry and treated that way was just humiliating beyond words. But that's
how long was your trip getting
about
back?
About 3 days. I was lost. I would end up at the bus station in Atlanta, and I just got lost. I couldn't figure it out, and then I couldn't get anybody.
You're not supposed to think about that kind of stuff at that age.
I just couldn't get anybody to help because, you know, nobody wanted to talk to the kid. And I was like, hey, I don't know what bus I'm supposed to get on. There's a million buses, and I don't know where to go. I'm just lost. And next thing you know, I missed my bus. So I just sleep there on the bench, and I was afraid to leave that spot because I thought if I leave, I'm going to miss the next bus.
Right.
So then I'd sit there and sit there all day long, and it was just like I couldn't get help. And finally, somebody helped me and said, you need to get on that bus right there. That bus will take you to Gastonia, North Carolina. And then I got on this bus, and it was I'm hungry. I'm so hungry. I hadn't eaten in a day and a half or something, and it was just like the last thing I ate was popcorn at the bus station. But I'm sitting in this on this bus, and this redheaded guy gets on. I'll never forget him. He had a big afro. It was red. He was a white guy. And he gets on the bus, and he sits down beside me. And I thought for a moment, this guy's weird because he's sitting beside a kid.
And he's sitting there thinking to himself, this kid's weird.
This kid's weird. But there's all these empty seats. And I'm like, why is this guy sitting beside me at 13? I mean, scared. Because, you know, you experience these
things.
Please
tell me he was an angel.
Well, he put this briefcase on his lap. And he said, he sat there a moment, and he said, are you hungry? And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And I said, yeah. And he popped the buttons on this briefcase, and he opened up, and it was filled with snacks, like crackers and all kinds of stuff. And he said, man, get whatever you want. And I just couldn't believe it. And I just grabbed a pack of crackers and I started eating them. And he pulled a joint out of the suitcase. And he said, hold this briefcase and I'll be right back. And he went back in the back of the bus and smoked this joint. and it, you could smell it. But he come back and he sat down. He said, "This is what I do, man. I smoke, eat, and ride." That's all he said. It was the truth. But the guy that you would at least expect would help you helped me. You know, it was the guy who was, not that I'm promoting it or you know.
Yeah, you're just saying that.
I'm just saying the guy that was a pothead helped me. You know, even during this walk, during my walk halfway across America, you know, the guy that helped me was a leader of the Hell's Angels.
Isn't that weird how help always comes from the person or the people that you least expect it to come from?
Absolutely. And not that I'm supporting any of that. I'm just saying it's like that's what it was. It was always that way.
I mean, I'm thinking Sons of Anarchy, and they stop in the middle of an episode to help out Jimmy Wayne, and they get back to whatever they're doing.
I've got to help you because it makes me feel good, and then I can go back to doing my crime.
In my biggest moment or my biggest crisis of faith moment, I was like 22, and my mentor at the time was a priest named Father Martin. You guys remember Father Martin?
Oh, yeah.
Let us pray.
He's this little bitty guy, and he talked just like this. And he was, I want to say he was in his late 50s, and he had been a priest, you know, his whole adult life. And I sat in his office one day, and I just said, "Father Martin, why do you believe in God?" Because he was such a smart guy. And, you know, people who believe in God are painted a lot of times to be
less educated
or just ignorant, whatever. And this was such a smart man, such an educated man. He's one of the most brilliant Bible scholars I ever met as a Catholic. And I was just, I just had to ask. And he said, "You know, the simplest answer is this. There have been times in my life when I really needed help, when I really needed somebody to come along and help me with, even if it was just someone to talk to or someone to feed me or someone to
snacks on a bus,
whatever." And he said, "And someone has always managed to be there to help me. And that person might have been someone who would have disappointed me every other time I'd encountered them. But when I needed someone and no one else was around, they were there to help me." Wow. He said, "I find that the people are always in the right place in my life. There was always someone when I needed them." He said, "That can't be a coincidence." He says, "There's something connecting all of us together, and I choose to believe that it's God." Mm. And I'm not giving it the proper explanation, but it's always stuck with me because life, 15 years have passed since then, and in my life, I will tell you that in my lowest moments, the people who have helped me are often people who otherwise have just, you know, have not been reliable, my friends who are not really the best friends, you know, the guys who always manage to be kind of like, you know, he's such a disappointment. But that's the guy who was there 6 years ago when I was, you know, drunk, face down on a bar, crying about my marriage. That's the guy who was there. You know, there was always someone in the right place at the right time. And it can't be, you know, it can't be a coincidence.
Well, my experience was when I was 16 and had, you know, just migrated out of the system. Obviously, when that bus—
Out of the foster care system.
Because when I got back to, finally made it to Gastonia and was picked up by the police and spent the next 3 years in and out of foster care, in and out of the system, living with strangers, friends, family, outside, couch surfing, in an abandoned trailer from home to home, group home to foster home, receiving home. I mean, it was just 3 years of that. I finally I was on my own at 16. I'm out looking for work because that's truly what saved my life was a work ethic, having a work ethic that I developed when I was a kid. You know, my granddad, of all the things that he didn't do, you know, he never changed a bicycle tire. He never threw ball or took me fishing or anything, but he always said, "You have to work. You have to physically work." And that just stuck with me. And so I've been working since I was, you know, a kid, 10 years old, working on a golf course, selling golf balls.
I did that too.
Yeah, man. You dig through the bushes. And
dude,
you...
I was the golf course, because I grew up, I'm a South Louisiana kid. I grew up right in the swamp. And the golf course was, you had to literally crawl around the snakes and the alligators and all that other junk in there. And we would collect them and sell them for a quarter a piece. And then we got, that paid for bicycles. That paid for all kinds of stuff. I could make $100 in a day easy sometimes because people lose golf balls like nuts. Yes. I wish I was one of those
guys.
Did
you ever dive for them?
I've been in the ponds for
them.
That's
crazy.
Yeah.
There is no way.
No way.
There is no amount of golf ball.
I had a buddy who would do it. Uh-uh. This is when we were 14, and I'm like, dude, this is New Iberia, Louisiana. There's no way there's not a moccasin or an alligator or something. Snapping turtle.
That's the thing. I got snapped once by a turtle, but I mean, I was lucky it got on my boot, and I was like, oh, thank goodness.
There is no way.
That sucks.
I don't even get in a. No.
All right. So you age out, and what you start. You start
I'm out,
working.
Yeah, I'm just out looking for work. I'm moving around from home to home, and I'm going down the road one day on a bicycle and just looking for work because that's how I provided food for myself. And I saw this doorway, a garage doorway. It was an old bay door that was open on a wood shop, and I saw an elderly man standing there cutting wood at a bandsaw, and something just said, go in and ask him if he has any work for you that you can do. And I did, and he didn't even look at me. He was cutting this dasher at this bandsaw, and he said,
flat top?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I know the guy you're talking about. Totally. Every neighborhood had him.
Absolutely.
Did you say he had a flat top?
Yeah.
He had a military. Yeah. He says, you need to ask the boss. And he nodded his head toward his wife, and this little white-haired lady in the back of the wood shop turned the saw off and walked toward me and looked me up and down. And despite the way I looked on the outside, because I was living outside, she asked me if I cut grass, and if I did, come back this afternoon. And I did, and I ended up being their lawn boy for the remainder of that summer. And every week I would cut their grass. She'd walk out to this fence and bring me a Coca-Cola. And
hence the shirt right there.
Hence the shirt, yep. I'm a huge Coca-Cola supporter because that's truly how she'd befriended me. And she'd bring me a Coca-Cola, talk about the weather, talk about the job I was doing. And every week it was this way. And toward the end of the summer, she asked me where I lived. And I got nervous because – I was thinking that if this 75-year-old lady knew anything about me and where I come from, she wouldn't want me around her house. So I gave her the most general answer I could think of. I looked at her and said, I just live up the road. And she said, my husband and I have been talking. I want to know if you'd be interested in moving into our home.
They didn't ask where up the road you live?
Nope. They just...
She knew.
Yeah, they had to know. I was wearing the same clothes every week. I would show up and I was dirty. I had long hair down my...
Probably not taking showers and all that, right?
It was horrible, man. It was horrible.
How long were you living under? It was under a bridge, right? Where were you living?
I lived in an abandoned trailer at one point for 2 weeks, and then I would just move from home, like this friend's home.
There was no bridge, was there? Where did I come up with
this bridge?
It
just sounds typical,
sounds
I guess.
Like it should be.
It should be. It should have been a bridge.
In Bubba's mind, you were a troll guarding from keeping goats from crossing the bridge.
Well, I showed up that day with I knew... I knew that it wasn't going to work out because, she said, move in with us. Because Russell and I, it was his name, the guy. The
flat top.
Flat top guy. He was a World War II veteran. So he and I had already made that eye contact because I'd been around their house enough and cut the grass that we had made eye contact. And he had given me that look that older men give you that lets you know, you're not going
to
be.
I'm on to you, son.
I'm on to you. And I knew that look. And I must have given him that look like a 16-year-old boy would give you, an older man, in addition to being homeless and, street smart and everything. I must have given him that look like, try me. But he was a killer. He was a World War II veteran that earned a Purple Heart. I mean, he's not going to take any crap from me. I wasn't going to give him any crap, but I sure wasn't going to listen to his rules, if you will.
So she asked you to stay
anyway,
with him.
She asked me to move in, and I showed up that afternoon. I knew it wasn't going to work out. I thought maybe 4 or 5 days, and I showed up at their house, rang the doorbell. Beatrice Costner was her name. She preferred you just call her B, first three letters of the word beautiful. And I remember her opening that storm door, and I stepped into their home. I've got this long hair down my back. I've got this plastic bag and this box of clothes. And Mr. Costner, his name was Russell, he was laying down in his recliner. And he never even raised up. He just laid there. And I walked into their home, and it smelled really good. It smelled like pie, like they were baking. She was baking something.
Something you hadn't smelled since your mom.
Smelled like home.
Yeah.
Smelled like Johnsonville, South Carolina. It took me right back to the cornfield. It took me right back to something safe, and it took me back home. That's what it took me.
You were like, wow, this exists again.
Yes, this is home. I know what that smell sounds that scent smells like, that scent sounds like. Whatever, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I know what you mean, sounds like mean sense.
Yeah, you're making no sense. So anyway, I walk across the living room, and Russell, I can feel him just staring at me. It's like tearing, just cutting through me. And so I didn't even unpack my bags. I left them laying down, laying in the room, and I just knew that he's going to make me leave. So why unpack? So about 3 or 4 days into this, I haven't had a conversation with him yet, and I'm walking out of the bedroom up the hallway, and he turns the corner. And now we're in a small hallway.
Confined, close quarters.
Can't get away. And then I'm like, oh, no, we're face to face. And so I started looking at all the pictures on the wall. Like I'm interested in the pictures on the wall.
Who are these people?
Who are these people? And he walks right up to me, and he puts his hand on my shoulder, and he says, I need to talk to you about something. And unlike me, he didn't talk a lot. You didn't misunderstand a single word he said.
When he spoke, he made sure you knew.
He was a military guy. And for instance, he did say this, and these are his exact words. These aren't mine. He said to me one time, he says, Jimmy, if you blow grass in my tulips again, I'm going to fire your ass. That's what he said.
And you'll remember that forever.
I remember those exact words. And I mean, it was so much. Anyway, so I immediately turned the lawnmower around and started blowing the grass that way.
Never
blew grass in his tulips
so
again.
So you're there in the hall.
I'm a hallway.
Puts his hand on
I need
shoulder.
To talk to you about something. And sit down. And everything was a direct order. I just respected him, and I'd never respected a guy before, because men that come into our lives as kids, they were always abusive, beat mom up, smack us. I just didn't respect them. Didn't trust them. Didn't respect them. But
weren't men. They were just dudes,
jerks. And man, there was just something about Russell though. He demanded respect. He looked at you when he was talking to you. And so he did just like this. He said, sit down. And he walked across the living room. He sat in his chair. I won't make you wait as long as he made me wait. He just stared at me for a moment. And he said, if you're going to stay in my home, there's two things you've got to do.
He's holding up three fingers?
Yeah. I wanted to tell him. But something said, keep my mouth closed.
Okay.
First thing you've got to do is you've got to cut off all of your hair. It has to be cut just like mine, which is that military cut. We want you to go to church. And if you don't do those two things, you've got to leave. And a part of me thought, well, I don't know why I thought this, but, you know, the haircut thing, he'll let it slide for a minute, you know, for a day or so, a week, month, maybe even a year.
But no.
As soon as I said okay, he said, get in a truck. And that was it. And I got in this big green Dodge farm truck, and we headed to the Dixie Village barbershop. Walked in, and he said, how you doing, Mr. Cole? Fine, Mr. Costner. What can I do for you? He needs a haircut. Sit down, boy. Sit down. He puts his cape around my neck, and he says, how's business going, Mr. Costner? And that was it.
Wow.
I was bald-headed. I had the military cut.
Wow.
Yep. I got out of the chair. I mean, there was hair that long in the floor.
That's down the middle of your back.
Oh, yeah. It was
yeah, I mean,
it's horrible.
Well, it's not like you'd had a haircut. You hadn't had a home
in
months.
I hadn't had a haircut in a long time. Very long time.
Wow.
I hadn't had a haircut since I think I was 14 something. So it was a year and a half, 2 years.
Wow.
It was long.
What about bath, like bathing in that time?
There's times I'd go 2 weeks. It's horrible.
Yeah, because I would think it would be hard to do. I mean, where would you go?
Just friend's house, or, you know, when you get picked up and put in a group home.
I mean, there's not any laundry. You're not doing any of that kind of stuff.
Nope. You're out, and you're...
How long are you with that family?
6 years. 3 months after I moved in, Mr. Costner was diagnosed with terminal cancer and passed away 3 months after I moved in. So I stayed with B 6 years. And
again, there you go. Yep. Just like we were talking about earlier, here you are. You're the kid that they would least expect... I'm about to cry. the person you would least expect to make their family whole... I mean, it's like God had a plan. I'm taking Mr. Costner, but I'm going to put Jimmy in his place.
Yeah. Well, you needed them,
and she needed you.
She said that. She said, I really believe you were sent here.
Wow. Dude,
and,
I'm like.
And being an angry kid, you know, I was an angry, frustrated kid, and I really didn't I believed in God, but I was really angry. You know what I mean? So when she started talking to me that way, I didn't say anything. I wasn't disrespectful, but I just kind of shook my head like, yeah, right, right, whatever. And 6 years of this, man, she truly changed every cell in my body. I mean, I went from being a homeless kid, living on the street, asking people for food. I mean, walking into convenience stores and just asking, can you give me some food, to going to high school. I went every single day of high school. I didn't even miss senior skip day. I was there every single day, 10th, 11th, 12th grade. I went to community college. They gave me an opportunity to work. They didn't give me the money. They made me work, and I went and worked at a factory and cut grass and saved up my money, paid for my tuition and my books, and graduated with my degree in criminal justice. Knew a lot about it. And I went to work at a state prison where I worked as an officer.
And that's where you learned how to play guitar.
4 years, absolutely.
And one of the inmates taught you, correct?
One of the inmates in there inspired me, encouraged me to play country music. And I heard him sing. He'd visited our school before I started working there.
On like a Scared Straight program?
Yes. It's called Think Smart. Think smart, don't be like me and make mistakes, you know.
Right.
So, and then when I saw him play, I was like, that's exactly what I wanted to do.
I don't think I ever told you this. I was at the Grand Ole Opry the night he was there.
Oh, wow.
Because somebody said
so
something.
I was about to ask, have you kept in touch with him?
Bubba, it was, man, that's a whole new story, but I'll share it. So he inspired me to play, and I would go visit him at the prison. And you know, the warden would
after
all,
you were done working there? Or
No. While I was in school, he visited my school.
Before you began working at the
right.
prison.
Okay. He visited my school, and I was so inspired by him. I was like, man, that's what I want to do. I mean, I want to share my story through music.
The person you least expect.
Exactly. And I thought, how can I get in touch with this guy? And I just talked to the guidance counselor at the school, and her dad happened to be the warden of the prison. And he's like, man, we don't let people in here to learn how to play guitar. We put people in here, and you know, we finally, I just begged them, please.
Who's
let
fighting
me
to get into prison?
Yeah, I'm like, let me in to meet with this guy. And so they finally let me visit him in prison, and we'd sit on the prison yard, and I'd watch him play. And that's that visual. I'd always learn visually, and I would watch and learn and watch and learn. And so I'd go home, and I bought a guitar at a yard sale, and then I would try to. Anyway, I eventually learned. He ends up getting out of prison, and I don't hear from him for 20-something years. Listen to this. This is going to blow your mind. So just 4 years ago, whenever it was, 4 years ago, I was standing in my kitchen listening to Christmas music, and it was frustrating because I'm like, why are we re-recording Christmas songs that
they were perfect already.
Yeah, why don't we record our original, write something new, something fresh, and come on, y'all. Stop messing up great Christmas songs. Sorry.
No.
You know what I mean?
I'm like, the phone rang?
If you can't, anyway, so I got on this high horse, and I thought, you know, like that Christmas song that prisoner sang at my school 20-something years ago. He sang a Christmas song in the springtime. And I'm like, why?
Something he wrote.
It's called For Days Like This. It was brilliant, man. And I thought, it gives me chills thinking about it. I was like, something like that. And then I thought, wonder what he's doing now. I wonder if he's even alive.
And so now you can Google things.
And now you have access to a computer, and you can find these people.
Was he still in the prison when you worked there, too?
No. I'm getting there. So he was already out. I went to work at that prison because the warden had been watching me on the yard and said, hey, man, you know, if you need a job, we'll hire you after you get out of school. Cool. So anyway, I ended up working there. And so we're talking about a career as a corrections officer, moving to Nashville, getting a record deal, putting all the music out. I'm doing all the stuff. After all of that, I'm standing in my kitchen. Now that's where we are. I'm standing there thinking about, where is this guy? I wonder if he's even alive. And so I went online and I looked up his name, Jody Hager. And there was a list of people from every country you can think of with that name. And I'm like, oh, boy, this is going to take years to find him. The first name on the screen, top left corner, was him. I called the number, and he said, hello? And I knew his voice. And I said, Jody, it's Jimmy. He said, oh, my God. Man, I've got to talk to you, but I can't right now. I'm kind of like, I'm at work and I'm not supposed to be on my phone. Can I call you after I get out of work? And I first thing I thought of is, at least he has a job. At least he's alive. At least he's doing okay. Anyway, he calls me. We talk, and over a period of about a month or so, I ask him, I was like, man, what happened after you got out of prison? I was visiting you and staying in touch, and all of a sudden you just disappeared. And I never heard from you again for 25 years or whatever it was. And he said, Jimmy, this is what happened, man. I got out of prison. I moved to Nashville. I got a record deal.
What?
What?
With him saying this?
Yes, with Asylum Records. Kyle Lenning signed him.
Yeah.
I got a publishing deal with Tree Publishing Company. Donna Hilly had signed him to. I mean, this guy would have been the next. I mean, he was absolutely phenomenal. He had the looks, the look, the charisma.
So what happened to him?
So he says, I got out, and back then they would give you a signing bonus, right? Took the signing bonus, bought some drugs, did not show up for recording, lost his record deal and his writing deal all within a two-month period. He said, I ended up back in prison. I spent 6 years in the big house in North Carolina, the big prison. He said, I would lay in my cell, door slammed on that little bunk, and I'd lay there and I would listen to you on the radio. Man.
Wow.
I mean.
And is that what got him straight again? Is no, he would listen to you? And
no, but the fact that he inspired me, I would visit him, he would mentor me, and ended up living his dream was just like, so I said, man, you know, you're 50 something years old now. What do you want to do? He said, man, my dad is sick. I always told him I'd like to sing at the Opry. And he'd be like, you need to stick to bricklaying. You need to stick to bricklaying. It's never going to happen. And he said, man, I'd love the opportunity to sing at the Opry. And I said, I just happen to have December 22nd. I'm going to be performing at the Grand Ole Opry. And I have two songs. They give me two songs to sing. I'll sing one. And I want you to walk out on stage and sing that Christmas song you sang when 20-something years ago when I was in high school that inspired me to do all this. I want you to come out and sing that song. And that's what he did. He came out to Nashville, and he walked out on stage at the Ryman Auditorium, and it was a standing ovation. It was unbelievable. Just a complete circle. That's what happened to him.
Do you remember that song that you – didn't you do a song about him?
I've written a – not about him. I've written a I've written a prison song. I wrote a prison song. It's called 4515. It was about another. Well, I've written a couple prison songs, but it's about a foster brother. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I remember there's a song that he did in the studio that was so good.
4515 or Blue and Brown.
I think it was Blue and Brown.
Yeah,
that sounds like it could be familiar. Real quick, I want to take this second to say thank you for everybody watching on Facebook. My phone battery is about to die, so I apologize. I'm going to have to stop the live stream on Facebook. So. Thank you, thank you, thank you for watching. Share this video. I'm telling you, this is the kind of stories that we need to hear more about. Jimmy Wayne could, if you could sit here for 3 hours, and I'm just going to listen. Yeah. You know, that's the beautiful thing about you. You've got such a good, sweet heart and all that, and you've lived such an incredible story. That's what we were talking about. When are they going to make the movie of the story of your life? But yes, if you want to finish hearing the rest of this conversation, go to the podcast. It'll be on there. But again, thank you for watching live. You absolutely rock. And Jimmy Wayne, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, I'm turning this off now.
Hey, would you grab the guitar? Mm-hmm. You play, what was that? Oh,
can you play something that isn't going to get us something you wrote or something you have the rights to? Sure. Because, you know, I think here, passing the, there's a green cord over there.
There's a green cord there for you to plug in.
I just remember there was a song that you did. It was about, I really want to say it was a song that it was like him talking to that guy, to that inmate. I thought it was you.
That's 4515. I know what you're talking about. That's not him, though.
Oh, it's not him.
I just need you to say, I am Jimmy Wayne, and I wrote this song, and I give you permission to have it on this podcast, because iTunes is real, real funny about that.
Hey, this is Jimmy Wayne. I am the writer of this song, and Big D and Bubba has my permission to post this song on their podcast.
There you
okay,
go.
There we go.
Talk about covering your butt right there.
Well, I was in for an 8-hour shift. He was in for life. As black and hardened as those barbells, I was green and white. We kept that 6-foot distance between a convict and a guard. And sometimes he'd yell out to me as I walked the mid-yard. Hey, CO, you know the difference between yourself and me. Ain't nothing except I got caught. It's crazy as that seems. We both wear these uniforms. We strip them all. And all a man is left with is his word and his name. We both planned our escape, 'cause every man's got a dream. And Ron's was to see his mom again, and mine was to pick and sing. Some nights after lockdown, going past his cell, I slip him a couple of dollars. I'd say, now don't you tell. Hey, CO, you know the difference between yourself and me. Ain't nothing except I got caught. It's crazy as that seems. We both wear these uniforms. We slip them all away. And all a man is left with is his word and his name. Well, I turned in my notice. I handed over my badge. I took one last walk across that yard and heard a voice behind me ask, hey, Elvis, you ain't too good for us. You think you could sing us a song? Well, they all gathered around me as I sing one about going home. I seen the hardest man I knew grow soft. Crooks, cons, and killers took their armor off. Ron handed me his mother's picture. He said, here, will you sign the back? I said, are you sure? He said, yeah, because I know I won't lose that. Hey, CO, you know the difference between yourself and me. Ain't nothing except I got caught. As crazy as that seems, we both wear these uniforms, but strip them all away, and all a man is left with is his word and his name. I was in for an 8-hour shift. He was in for life. He was black and hardened as those barbells, and I was green and white.
Isn't that great?
So amazing.
So that was the first autograph I ever signed. And it was a convict that had been on death row, and he was commuted to life. And in the prison system, you know, the rules are you don't stand close to a convict. And because when they talk to you or you talk to them, everyone has to hear what you're talking about. Because if he's too close, then other convicts will assume he's telling you something that he doesn't want
right,
to hear.
Right, he's a snitch. Right, okay.
Snitch, yeah. And the saying in prison is snitches get stitches, and they mean it. So when they talk to you, it's from here to you and I. So it's he gets real close to me, and I was afraid because I was like, man, he's going to shank me or something. And why? I mean, this is really, for someone like him to do it, who's a 30-year veteran in the prison system. I mean, this guy had been in 30 years. He knows better than that. But he walked right up to me, and he reached in his pocket, and he pulls out a wallet and pulls out his mother's picture and asked me to sign it. Now, besides the fact that he's that close to me, he's an African-American guy. here I am, a white corrections officer, and he's asking me to put my signature on his mother's picture.
Wow.
Man, I tell you, brother, that was so powerful. I mean, it was really very powerful. And I just said, man, are you sure you want me to sign my name on your mom's picture? And he said, yeah, because I know I won't lose it.
Oh, jeez. Wow.
I was like, golly, man. When I got to Nashville, I wrote that song down, man. I was like, man.
How many of those guys, I mean, that was 20 years ago?
Yeah.
How many of those guys do you think are still there?
He ended up paroling out of prison. Wow. And he and his wife and granddaughter were going down the road, and they hit an ice patch, and a car flipped.
No.
Yep.
Died?
Died, yep. Yep. Oh. Died.
Well, at least he was with his family. I mean, that's the only positive.
They all died
it.
Or just him?
I think he and the granddaughter died.
Oh, well, that sucks.
Yep.
Wow.
I was trying to make it a little bit better. And
yep. I was not that I'm bragging about this, but I was talking to a homeless guy the other day, just 3 days ago in my hometown. And he asked me, he said, man, when you I don't need any money. I just need some food.
Did he know who you were?
Nope.
Okay.
And I said, well, come on in here. And we went into Tony's Ice Cream, and it's where I go every time I'm at home. And we sat down in a booth. And I said, what do you want? He told me what he wanted. He about broke the bank, man. I'm like, dude, come on. Just kidding. Just kidding. He ordered like 15 burgers, and I'm like, come on,
did
man.
He really?
Yeah.
Everybody gives you look like really?
I'm like, I mean, you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
So
how about five?
Yeah, how about five? Not anyway, so. Anyway, he ordered like three burgers and, you know, whatever. I didn't care. I was laughing about it because I was. And we sat down and we talked, and I asked him his name, and he told me his name, and it was, he's kin to that guy.
No.
Kin to the guy. And I said, do you happen to know Ron Hill? He said, yeah. I said, I wrote a song about him. He's like, really? He's like, you know he died, right? I said, yeah, I know he died. So then I knew he knew. He wasn't lying.
Yeah. Right.
So I was like, yeah, I knew he died. He said, wow. And he said, thanks for the food. He got up and walked out.
And that was it.
Watched him walk down the road.
You ever thought about doing a live album a la Johnny Cash, go back to the prison where you used to work and do a concert?
Yeah, it'd be fun, man.
You're the guy who can do it, you know?
Well, I got enough songs, I think, that I could pull it off.
Cash and Merle used to go back and play in prisons because they had been in them. He could go back and play prisons because he used to work at them. That's a whole different thing, though.
And I think if you told the stories along with it, they would just, that's crazy. You know, my church was doing that where they were going to prisons and doing little outreach things. And I don't want to say the choir, but they had a little group that would get together and go do all the churches. And it was a brilliant idea because who else is going to reach out to them?
Yeah.
Nobody.
Hey, when you were doing the walk, what was the interaction with the Hell's Angel guy?
It was, he noticed my foot was broke. I had a boot on, and he's like, "Hey, he was at a hotel checking in." And that night, I stayed at a hotel. The local radio station there hooked me up with a room because I was in pain, brother. I was in so much pain, and I'm sitting there in the lobby, and he just says, "Hey," I don't know why he spoke to me. I didn't wave at him. I didn't do anything. He just spoke to me. He says, I said, hey, I'm Jimmy. I'm walking across America for, raise some awareness for these kids. And he's like, cool, man. Buy yourself some food. And he gave me like $100 bill. I was like, that is really weird. And he was like the president of the Arizona chapter or something like that.
Oh.
Very strange. And his jacket said, Hell's Angels. And as he's walking away, I put up my phone video and I filmed him walking away.
This dude just gave me some money.
I'm like, I don't even turn around and look at me, but I'm doing this.
The stories that he has of walking across America.
Oh, God.
Just seriously, get the book because it'll fill you in on a lot.
And it still doesn't tell everything. I mean, the stuff that I saw out there on that walk, I've had the funniest stories, and I have the absolute grossest stories you could possibly imagine. If there weren't any documentation of it, you wouldn't believe it. You would not believe it. What you couldn't believe it, because the things that I saw and experienced, I mean,
part of me wants to ask, tell me about the growth story.
No,
the other part's going, no, you know what?
Not here. Not with that.
I got a growth story.
You promise you'll tell me one later?
I got it now if you want to hear it.
I'm going to just walk out.
Real quick, I do want to say this. Before we do, we're going to do that as a bonus here on the podcast. So are we about done? We're going to wrap this up? We're about done with the podcast?
D's
like, I thought he was going to tell the story.
Well, no, I want to say that because I want to get the Subway thing in because they do help pay for the podcast and all. So this summer at Subway, explore the flavors from around the globe with Lay's Passport to Flavor Chips, the creamy zip of Greek tzatziki, the spicy heat of Chinese Szechuan, tikka masala, and even the bold steakhouse flavor of the Brazilian picanha. Pair them with the favorite sandwich of your choice or the full Jet Set experience, or you can even try the new Subway Chicken Caesar Melt, baby. It is perfect with the cool crispness of Lay's Wavy Greek Tzatziki Chips. So get to Subway now. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Experience a whole new world of flavor with Lay's Passport to Flavor Chips before they're gone. And now, the bonus. Okay, tell us the growth story.
Well, you may not want to eat after you hear the story.
Oh, man.
That's why you have to read the commercial first.
I'm just saying.
Okay.
So I'm walking through a specific area.
Okay.
All right.
You just dropped that on the ground.
A girl drove past me in a big pickup truck. I can hear the tires. Woo, 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 woo. I'm like, oh boy. Big old high rise.
And they're stopping.
Four wheel drive, stopping. I'm surrounded.
People are following you because you were tweeting about it and telling them,
people
okay,
where I'm at. And plus, I'm wearing a ski suit. And there's swamps on both sides of the road. And it's a gazillion miles of swamp. And I'm out there. I mean, if I had to, like, use the restroom, there's nowhere to go because you step off that road, there's a swamp. It was that bad. And so this truck stops, and this girl gets out and says, hey, are you Jimmy Wayne? Yes, ma'am, I am. Can my friend, a long story short, can my friend take a picture with you? I said, sure. And so her friend is like, I was like, there's got to be a place to pull off up here somewhere. And there was. And it was a little side road where people would put boats and they'd go duck hunt, right?
Okay.
So we stopped there. I'll be up there in a minute. And I keep walking. And so her friend won't get out of the truck. And I said, look, she's got to get out of the truck before I can take a picture. I'm not going to get in a truck with her.
Right.
Come on, get out of the truck. She finally gets out. And she's like, she's real shy. And she's like, well, will you hold my wallet? I was like, huh?
Hold your wallet?
I said, hold your wallet. She's like, yeah. So I held her wallet. I said, only if you're in the photo, because it was a pink camouflage wallet. It's a camouflage print,
yeah, right.
But pink. And so I'm holding this wallet. She said, will you hold my pocketbook with the wallet? I said, oh, my God.
Okay.
And now I'm holding this thing, and she's smiling. And then all of a sudden I say, what's that smell? And we both look over in the ditch, and there was a raccoon that had died.
Okay.
And I don't know why I said this, because she said, you know, before we saw that, she started telling these redneck jokes. You might be a redneck if, you know, your dog, front porch falls in and kills three.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I was like, you might be a redneck. So we're going back and forth with these redneck jokes. And then all of a sudden I said, what's that smell? The wind had blown. And I said, you might be a redneck if you bite the toenails off of that raccoon.
Shut your mouth.
No.
Now, I am an animal lover. I am an animal lover. Yeah. I do not promote violence against live or dead animals.
And this one was definitely dead.
Dead.
Bloated. And
I did not think in my right mind that this girl would do what I dared her to do. I was just trying to get...
Yeah,
I was being a boy in school saying, you might be a redneck if you bite the toenails off that raccoon. Ha, ha, ha,
dude,
move on.
We got it.
Yes.
Yeah.
She said, how much you give me? I said, I'll give you $100.
Oh. Now we're talking about redneck girl Big D. Because he's the same way. If you throw money in, he will do anything. I can tell you.
Well, I didn't think she would do it.
Oh.
I didn't think she would do it. And she got down on the ground. I said, whoa, hold on a minute. Don't, you know, hold on. I said, and I'm still trying to save face. But I'm trying to get her not to do this, talk her out of it. So I'm like, well, I'm going to stream it live. So the she's like, well, what's streaming? I said, where everybody can see it all over the world.
That's what I thought would deter him on one of the grossest
she
things
she said,
he's ever
I'm
done.
I'm going to be famous.
Oh, boy.
She leaned over.
No.
And she bit the toenail on this raccoon.
This dead raccoon.
And started twisting her head. And she said, it won't come off. And I'm telling you, I literally about passed out. And I'm like,
see, I would have had dry heaves. I'd have been.
I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And of course, Twitter, everybody that's following me on Twitter and Ustream at the time lost their mind. I got so much hate mail. They hated me because they're like, I can't believe you're out there walking
it's
across.
It's your fault, Jimmy.
You're walking.
That's what they were saying.
Yeah, you're walking for these kids, and now you got some woman biting a raccoon toenail. And I'm like, come on, man. I didn't think she would do that.
Nobody thinks anybody would do that.
I didn't think she would really get down there and bite a raccoon foot.
But come on. A little bit of all of us goes, I hope she does.
Everybody was watching.
Of course.
And then when she looked up at me, she looked up at me, there was raccoon hair on her face that had come off the dead raccoon.
No, that was actually her beard.
That's awesome. Daddy says.
My daddy boyfriend.
Daddy.
My raccoon toenail.
All right, that's pretty nasty.
Yep, it was disgusting.
All right, are we done now? I'm done. I can't handle any more of this. Dude. One day I'm going to tell the Big D story. One day.
It was so great to see you again.
Good seeing you, brother. Good seeing both of y'all.
Same here, man.
And I would love that you could tell more long form of your story.
Okay, I have plenty. Plenty of stories.
No, I'm saying I'm glad you could do it today.
Oh, thank you.
Jeez.
In other words, don't. I'm just not an invitation to come back and tell more. I'm just
don't
saying,
let
I'm just
the door thing. Hit you in the butt.
I'm going to give you $100 if you will bite Patrick's toenails off. Hey, Patrick, come here.
No.
All right. Thank you, Jimmy Wayne. Follow him on Twitter at Jimmy Wayne. You can watch all the exciting stuff
there. $100.
Oh, my God.
Would you
put them shoes back on.
Would you bite his toenail? Would you bite his toenail for $100 for charity?
No.
No, I wouldn't let him.
No.
For $200
No,
I wouldn't let him.
Nope.
$2,000.
Nope.
For the kids.
No.
I mean for the children.
No.
Small kids who could really use that money.
Stop it. He knows where to hit me, doesn't he? He knows exactly where to hit me.
$5,000.
He knows exactly where to hit me.
I'm not doing it.
We gave you $5,000.
Put your shoe back on, Pat.
Gave you $5,000.
Put that sock on, dude. All right. Put the sock on. All right. Ain't happening.
Thank you for listening.
Someone don't love kids.
Can't wait till the next podcast.
This was the podcast, but now it's over. But that's okay, because you can listen to the regular show. On the radio every day. It was the podcast.
You guys are hysterical.